All right, good evening. The title they gave me to start with, actually it's been months ago now, but what I was studying for was Worship in Nature, the Life of St. Francis. And I did go into study fully intending to use that title, but the more I studied, the more that I felt like that constricted me a little bit, so I wanted something a little more open-ended. St. Francis of Assisi, his life and mission. And so I feel this will give me what I need to talk about it. So first of all, before I start, the sources I used primarily for this talk was a book by G.K. Chesterton, St. Francis of Assisi. It's a biography. There are many biographies of St. Francis available, but I chose to go with this one to hopefully stick with at least a somewhat consistent storyline and narrative. I did also use a biography of St. Francis available online at biography.com, as well as a number of other online sources for other less important references within this talk. So, before we talk about St. Francis, I think it would be appropriate to talk about the world he was born into. He was born in 1181 in Assisi, Italy, which is, there's a black dot there in Italy, central Italy there, just north of Rome. And at the time of his birth, much of central Europe was dominated by the Holy Roman Empire. This map is actually not quite accurate as far as time period. It was slightly larger at the time of his life, but it was the closest free map I could find, so went with that. Anyway, as far as other contexts around the rest of the country and the world, to the northwest, England and France are at war, as they typically were during this time period, so that's not really notable, but I thought I'd put that in there. The rest of Europe has just emerged from the Dark Ages a few decades earlier. And this is important in the story because what we're starting to see throughout this time period is the very first hints of the Reformation and the Renaissance. The Renaissance won't be for another year, 100 years or so, and the Reformation not for 300 years, but we do start seeing some moves from a peasant-based society to more of a like city and government structure. And I think that is important in why St. Francis came over the way he did with his mission. To the far to the southeast, the Holy Lands and much of the Middle East and North Africa is under Muslim rule. This was before the Ottoman Empire. They simply referred to it as the Saracens, just a general area that was under Muslim rule based out of Egypt. And as you may guess, with those two very dominant powers that close to each other, there was a lot of fighting, including the Crusades. The first three Crusades had already happened, and the fourth and fifth happened during Francis's life. And those are also important. We'll talk about that after a while. And then zooming out to the rest of the world as a whole, it was fairly quiet except for Asia. Asia, Genghis Khan is just starting to really get started conquering a lot of Central Asia. During Francis's lifetime, he goes on to conquer China and then much of Western Asia as well. So this is the world that Francis was born into. So, Giovanni de Pietro di Bernardone was born in 1181, or actually we're not certain on his birth. It was either 1180 or 1181, not 100% sure. He was born in Assisi, Italy. And you might be wondering about that name. As it turns out, his father was away in France on a business trip at the time. So his mother named him John, or Giovanni in Italian. And when his father returned, he apparently did not like the name or thought he could think of something better. So he renamed him to Francesco, or Francis, as we would refer to it in English. And that was possibly a nod to his recent business success in France. So that is how he became known as Francis, and that name did stick with him the rest of his life. I don't think anybody ever knew him by Giovanni. Continuing with his childhood, he lived a very favored childhood. His father, Pietro di Bernardone, was a cloth merchant. And at that time, that was a good business. He sold silk and other cloth around throughout South Central Europe and was apparently quite wealthy. So Francis was able to live a very favored childhood. In Francis's youth, there were a number of notable things. Again, as I said, he lived somewhat of an extravagant lifestyle. he was fascinated with the troubadour lifestyle. And a troubadour is somewhat like a French poet or minstrel that would travel around singing for a living. Very colorful, adventurous lifestyle, basically. And he really wanted to be one. And he really also loved money, bright clothes, wine, and parties, and was known for his vanity and charm. Apparently, he was one of those sorts of people who were popular with everybody, and his charms as a troubadour made him sort of a romantic ringleader among the young men of town. And he threw his money around in both extravagance and benevolence in a way of a man who has never exactly known what money is. And in addition to all of this, he was also fascinated with knights and warfare, and really wanted to go to war and win fame as a knight before embarking the rest of his life, I guess, because he also wanted to be a troubadour. But anyway, there's one notable story that sticks out from his early youth, and that was when he was in the market selling cloth for his father, and he was apparently talking to a merchant and arranging a sale when a beggar came up to them and demanded and asked for money, and Francis felt pity for him, because Francis, even from his youth, seemed to always have pity for those who were downcast and out. Anyway, so he felt conflict, though, because he was committed to his business and he wanted to finish the business deal with the merchants. So he ignored the beggar and finished his sales or whatever, and then left the rest of his cloth and everything there in the market unattended and raced after the beggar and tracked him down and found him and gave him all the money that he had with him. But despite this story, there is still no evidence at any time that there was any mystical or saint-like quality to Francis. He was, quite simply, a fairly normal young man for his society. And this is noteworthy because oftentimes writers and historians point to his early life as hints and rumors of the sainthood within. But in reality, he was unexceptional. He was fascinated with the life of the troubadours and of the French and wished nothing more than to be a French poet. And he thought and may have wished to win his fame as a soldier first. In all this, Francis was a really ordinary young man, and it is when we realize how ordinary he was that we realize what an extraordinary young man he was. When Francis was about 21, war broke out between Assisi and the neighboring state of Perugia. And as with medieval Europe, this was also very common, not very remarkable. But Francis eagerly enlisted. He wanted a taste of war. Unfortunately, Francis and the rest of the men of Assisi came under heavy attack almost immediately, and most of the troops got killed. Francis was unskilled and had no combat experience, and he was quickly captured by the enemy soldiers. But since he was dressed like an aristocrat and was probably wearing expensive armor, they decided that he might be worth a ransom. So, along with a few other wealthy soldiers, they threw him in prison. So he was led off to a dark underground cell, and there he remained for about a year. And we don't really know what all happened while he was there, but we do know that about a year later, he was possibly ransomed by his father, not certain, and was able to be released from prison. But that release from prison also came with a severe sickness that plagued him then for the rest of his life. It was a recurring sickness. Now, this event was not, as some people will say, the turning point in his life. While the sickness did certainly make him more serious, it did not remove his desire for war and fame. For as soon as his town marched again to battle, a year or so later, Francis, believing in a dream that he had had that called him to war, he thought, went rushing off again to battle. But since he had not fully recovered from his sickness, he got very sick again on the way and was forced to return to Assisi in shame. So it was after this, while he was drifting desolately around Assisi, that he met a leper on the road. Now one of Francis's greatest fears was lepers, and that was fairly normal for that society again. Lepers were common, but also put down and shoved out of town and forced to live in their own camps for fear of contagion and whatnot. So this was one of Francis's greatest fears, but he also felt compassion for them. And so as he met this leper on the road, he overcame his fear and leapt down and hugged the man, and gave what money he could to him. And it was at this moment that Francis began to change. He said that after he hugged the man, he felt such inexpressible joy that he knew he was called to serve the beggars and the lepers and the outcasts. And it was this that was really the turning point in his life. After this, soon after this, he and a few other friends went on a pilgrimage to Rome, since they were Catholic, after all, and hoped to find word from God there. And while there, he felt like he was called again, felt confirmed to minister to the poor and the beggars. So these experiences marked the beginning of the turning point in Francis's life, and it was soon followed by more change. It is told that as Francis was praying in front of the crucifix in the ruins of an abandoned church in Assisi, as he had taken to doing since he came back from war, he heard a voice speak to him. And the voice said, "Francis, seest thou not that my house is in ruins? Go and restore it for me." Now, Francis had also been longing to go and do something. He had been unable to go to war. Both times he had gone, he had ended in failure. And his sickness perhaps prevented him from becoming a businessman. And so he was very eager to go and do something. And when he felt this call from God, he reacted perhaps too eagerly to it. He thought God was talking about the physical church that he was praying in, which was the abandoned St. Damian's church there in Assisi. And so he immediately began to go about trying to rebuild that. But he needed money to rebuild a church. And so he first sold his horse, which belonged to his father, and then went on to sell a number of bales of his father's cloth as well. Unsurprisingly, his father was less than impressed and did not really support this vision, and so he forced him to stop and return the goods and locked him up until he would change his mind. And through all of this, it was quite depressing for Francis because it felt like his efforts to rebuild God's house had only resulted in his own house coming down around his ears, and he felt he needed more. So when he was released and brought before the bishop for judgment for his crime, he made it clear that he was following his call. He stood up before them and said, "Up to this time, I have called Peter Bernardone my father, but now I am a servant of God." And then proceeded to give back all his father's money, and even went so far as to strip most of the clothes from his back and throw them at his father's feet. From here, he turned and went out into the cold world, turning his back on society, his family, and his friends. And in reality, his friends and family turned their back on him as well. His father completely rejected him from this time on, and we don't know that he continued interacting with the rest of his friends and family. We don't hear any of that. So, Francis continued working to restore the church on his own. He still believed he was supposed to restore the physical church there. And so he went around the countryside of Assisi, begging for building materials and stones rather than food and money, and lived only on the poorest scraps of food and clothing that people would give him, because he was too humble and afraid to ask for more than crusts of bread. So despite this strange, crazed vision, surprisingly, there were others that were willing to join him. The first two brothers that joined were a merchant from Assisi there, and a monk from a nearby town. And it really was quite surprising that even those joined, because the town most likely saw him as a young man that had just robbed his father, and whose only excuse was that he had heard a loud voice speaking in his ear to repair a church. Despite this, Francis's passion for the poor and outcast was contagious, and his first two followers began multiplying into more and more. But in an attempt to more closely mimic the walk of Christ, they at first limited their number to 12, the 12 Italian disciples of Christ, if you will. But their vision extended beyond this. These 12 felt like they should go to Rome, to the Pope, and present their method of life and worship so that they could become a part of the larger church, rather than remain a heresy. And journey to Rome they did. And once there, they requested an audience with the Pope. While at first he was reluctant to speak with these beggar monks, he did eventually hear them out. And it seems the papacy attempted to reason with the men, describing the unnecessary hardships and probable tragic end of their lives. But they were eventually won over and agreed that however hard, it was commanded in the Bible, so they weren't going to stop them. The Pope gave assent to his request, and the first order of the Franciscans was formed. From here on, the order grew quickly, perhaps with the added confidence that these crazy monks, were supported by the Pope. They quickly developed a large following. And in fact, this following soon outgrew just these monks and outcasts, and soon a second order for women was formed, known as the Poor Clares, named for their leader, a young nun, that would eventually become known as St. Clare. And it grew even beyond these two. A third order was formed for those who were committed to physical and spiritual poverty, but were not able to leave their home due to family or business, and could thus support it in spirit, I guess. So, coming to the next big event in Francis's life, it's involved war once again. This time, it was the Crusades. The Fifth Crusade began in about 1217, and Francis felt called to go. But he did not go as he had gone to war before as a soldier, but he went as himself. He and a fellow brother did their best to make their way to Egypt as quickly as possible. And to them, that meant simply going down to the harbor and boarding the first ship to Egypt they found. And that was not with tickets. They were stowaways underneath the deck. But that was an ill-fated voyage, and it was plagued with bad weather and trouble, and it returned just a few weeks later to Italy without having gone to Egypt. And so they were forced to pursue other methods of getting there. They did eventually get to Egypt, to Damietta, which is the headquarters of the Muslim rule there on the front lines of the war. And once there, Francis wasn't content just being there. He went and pushed through the enemy lines and demanded an audience with the Sultan, the leader of the Muslim army there, Malik al-Kamil. Amazingly, he was actually granted this privilege, and he was able to plead his case for ending the war before him. Francis went to these lengths because he wanted a bloodless crusade. He wanted both the war to end and to be successful. And how better for it to succeed than to bring the Muslims to Christ rather than kill them? Sadly, this was not to be, and the Sultan brushed off his request, and Francis safely returned to Italy, with the war still going on. This is really quite sad, really. It's one of the great could-have-beens of history. An event that could have united the East and the West failed, and the Holy War served to only permanently deepen the divide. So it's really a shame. The Crusades still affect relations between Christians and Muslims to this day. And had Francis been successful, it might have ended very differently. The story of Francesco di Bernardone was only to continue for another decade or so, but it wasn't over yet. Upon returning to Italy, he found that the movement he had started had spread like wildfire, and was perhaps even getting a little too popular, since he had to admonish some of the groups of friars because they were accepting too generous donations from the public and from wealthy merchants. And he had to remind them that they had taken their vows of poverty and chastity earlier, and so they couldn't be accepting this money. However, once a generous merchant approached Francis with a rather surprising gift, he offered to give him an entire mountain in Italy. And since the rules of the order apparently had not made provision for giving mountains, Francis accepted it. Mount Alverno, as it was called, became sort of a solitude place for him, where he would retreat for days at a time to pray. And it was also here, some years later, that he received his final vision from God, and through which, some say, he received the actual stigmata, or the wounds of Christ, in his hands, feet, and side. Whether he did or not, we don't know for sure. Some historians say it was as fact, but some say that it wasn't so. Whatever. The rest of Francis's life was clouded with the same sense of the coming end. Francis never really fully recovered from the sickness as a youth, and his hard life of constant action, poor food, and poor living conditions took their toll. He was also going blind. He was already kind of an old man, and he was only in his 40s. And they'd actually attempted to treat his blindness, and the method they used I thought was rather interesting. Apparently you heated a piece of metal red hot and scalded the front of your eyeball, which did not seem effective to me, but anyway. He was blind certainly after that. As he watched the movement he had begun become more organized and watched as many men and women took oaths of poverty and a life devoted to helping others, I can't help but think that Francis must have been satisfied. Not with himself and not with his own work, he was too humble for that, but with what God had accomplished in his lifetime. Francis died in 1226 at the age of only 45. And as he lay on the bare ground, uncovered at his own request, he was surrounded by those he had loved and served with and for. For Francis there, we can be sure as he died that he saw nothing but the face of his Creator and of Jesus his Lord. But for those standing around him, there were perhaps other thoughts. The man who lay dying there was a person, a poet, even an outlook on life that would perhaps never be seen again among the followers of Christ. He had set an example for them in following Christ, and then lived it out better than any of them could ever. He had started a reformation in Italy, a turning from the simple life of the Dark Ages to what would become the Reformation much later, the vibrant growth of Christianity throughout Europe and then the rest of the world. And his example did not die with him that October day, but it grew. He truly was an extraordinary, ordinary man. So having looked at the life of this young Italian, it is clear that we have much to learn from him. His life and walk so clearly demonstrated a love for Christ that it enabled him to forsake literally everything he had and to follow Christ no matter the difficulty. So what caused this man to be so committed to serving the poor, to feeding the downcast and the sick and the leper, and to love all of them and to love his fellow man no matter who they were? What did this man believe? To better understand why he lived the way he did, I feel it would be fitting to first look at some of his own writings. Not many writings of his have survived from the 13th century, which is partly because writing was not widespread during that time, and Francis was also not a great writer. What we do have is a long list of guidelines covering life within the Franciscan order. We have a poem he wrote, The Canticle of the Sun, which is rather long, so I won't read it here, but it basically is praising brother sun, sister water, sister earth, brother fire, and the rest of God's creation, and praising it all and bringing it back to God. And we also have a number of letters written between Francis and some of his contemporaries during the time. And through these, we can gain insight into his beliefs. Notably, one writing that is not included in his original writings is the Prayer of St. Francis. You all are probably familiar with that. And while that is certainly fitting with his mission and spirit, it was not written by him. It was written several hundred years later by someone. It's entirely different. So, anyway, so I'm going to read for you a few of the ordinances for the Franciscan order, and I think we can learn more about their beliefs from that. This is one of the first. Again, there's like 30 or so I'm just going to read a couple here. So this is of the Imitation of the Lord. Let us all, brothers, consider the Good Shepherd, who to save his sheep bore the suffering of the cross. The sheep of the Lord followed him in tribulation and persecution and shame, in hunger and thirst, in infirmity and temptations, and in all other ways. And for these things they have received everlasting life from the Lord. Wherefore it is a great shame for us, the servants of God, that whereas the saints have practiced works, we should expect to receive honor and glory for the reading and preaching of the same. So here he's saying that to actually receive honor and glory for our works, we have to follow the Lord in tribulation and persecution and shame and hunger and thirst and infirmity and temptations, which the Franciscans certainly did. We cannot just expect to receive honor and glory for simply reading and preaching about what they've done. It's another one. Of poverty of spirit. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Many apply themselves to prayers and offices and practice much abstinence and bodily mortification, but because of a single word which seems to be hurtful to their bodies, or because of something being taken from them, they are forthwith scandalized and troubled. These are not poor in spirit, for he is truly who is truly poor in spirit hates himself and loves those who strike him on the cheek. And I think we have few greater examples since the time of Christ of somebody who did hate himself as much as Francis was willing to do, and who was truly poor in spirit. And this one, of true humility. Blessed is he who shall be found as humble among his subjects, as if he were among his masters. Blessed is the servant who always continues under the rod of correction. He is a faithful and wise servant, who does not delay to punish himself for all his offenses, interiorly by contrition, and exteriorly by confession, and by works of satisfaction. And again, I think Francis was one of the best examples we have of someone who was truly humble. So, these ordinances, there were a lot of them, and they were fairly strict. They had to abandon all earthly wealth and friends and family and solely pursue a life following Christ as closely as they could. And I think they did an excellent job of following these rules. They were harsh, but they were also able to keep them, which is what makes their sincerity even more valuable. So, from these, we can see that there were two things, at least, that were of utmost importance to Francis. That was to follow Christ as closely as he could, and to crucify his own flesh so totally that there was none of himself left to distract from his call. And this Francis did well. Many of Christ's commands he fulfilled so well that many wondered if he hadn't gone a bit too far. Christ said, "Blessed are the poor," but did he really mean that we should become the poorest of all to receive that blessing? Christ tells us to give to the poor and to comfort the widow, but did he really mean that we have to give everything that we have? Francis not only fulfilled these commands, he went beyond that. Francis lived a life following Christ's commands so closely that there was sometimes little difference between him and what Christ said. Francis completely gave up everything here on earth. He lived outdoors, often, under the stars, living on the poorest of food and in the poorest of clothing, and he was still willing to serve Christ and be generous with others. He was able to reduce himself so far that nothing could distract him from serving and worshiping Christ. So coming into this study, my impression of this man was more of that of an extremely humble man, content to worship outdoors in nature alone. And while he was certainly humble, my perspective has changed. I've begun to see that Francis was really a man with passion, driven on to serve Christ. Francis did not worship nature so much as respect it. He was so passionate about God and everything he created that he respected each animal and tree as if it were of equal value to himself. As Chesterton says, Francis couldn't see the forest for the trees because he cared about each of the trees. He couldn't see the mob approaching him because he only saw each individual. End quote. Often in his writings, he refers to things around him as brother and sister, brother sun, sister earth, brother bird, etc. And it truly seems like he thought of them all as God's valuable works and as loved by God and just as valuable as he was himself. And so I think the stories we hear of him preaching to nature aren't necessarily as much him trying to convert them as just he felt so passionately that they were also important to God that how could he leave them out of hearing the good news, even if they were animals or trees or whatever. So I think I've come to view Francis more as a medieval Apostle Paul. He was a man so driven by his pursuit of Christ that he would go at any expense, even to the front lines of war, to throw himself through enemy forces and kneel at the in front of the leader there and ask him to turn to Christ. He was so driven that his actions sometimes approached madness. So driven that he became much closer to Christ than many of us will ever be. So what can we learn from Francis? I think one of the first and most important things is humility. Francis left himself completely behind as he went through life. And while he was human, and certainly not always perfect, he was better at it than most of us. In my study, I found that he was really probably the most humble human I have ever read of. A second important thing is his love and respect for creation. Francis had a deep love of all things created by God and respected each one. I think we can grow in this too, not taking for granted what is around us, but being thankful for what God has made and realizing the value and detail in all of it. The third thing we can learn from him is courage. Francis looked at the Beatitudes and saw Jesus' blessing for the poor in spirit, so he became poor in spirit. He saw Jesus tell us to comfort the sick and help the poor, so without questioning, Francis did just that. When he felt God calling him to go to the Crusades, he didn't hesitate. He went straight away and made his way there. Francis had tremendous courage to live his countercultural lifestyle, and he really lived it well. Francis was a very ordinary man in many respects, but he was also an extraordinary man by the same virtue. We too could become more intentional about our walk with Christ, and all of us could certainly improve our poverty of spirit. So, can we all forsake what we have and commit more fully to following Christ? Maybe for us that doesn't mean abandoning our life and living completely off the generosity of others and being the poorest of the poor. But there's still room for growth in all of our lives. We can all improve in poverty of spirit, in humility, in courage, in respect for those around us and for the creation around us. So I think it's really important that we let the example of this ordinary Italian man encourage us to better serve God with humility and courage. So that's all I have about him specifically, but I would take time for your questions at this time if you feel there's things I missed or would like to cover. I would take any questions you might have. Joseph.
You mentioned that the prayer that we are familiar with was not written by him. Why was it named after him? Do you know that?
Well, I think it was specifically written in honor of him. So, and it certainly does follow what he would have said. It just didn't show up until several hundred years later. So I think the author was just trying to make it as true to his life as possible. And it's still a powerful prayer, not discrediting that. So. Yes, it is. I think there's two main orders of monks nowadays. It's the Franciscan and the Benedictine. Those are both still going today. And Francis is still hugely celebrated among the Catholic community. There's a holiday for him. It's in October. I think it celebrates his death every year. And there's huge celebrations around his life. He's also the patron saint of ecology and animals. So he's also celebrated by those people and that as well.
Did you find anything about him having a special communion or way with birds, or is that our animals? Is that
There's a lot of at least allusions to that. I never found any direct stories about that, but he is often depicted as talking to animals and stuff around him, so there probably was some truth to that. I don't know. I didn't find anything specifically on that. Any other questions?
Yeah.
There you go.
By works of satisfaction. Did you sense that he was seeing things right? Penance or whatever?
I don't know. He was Catholic, so I'm really not sure how much of the Catholic practice he was involved in. I do think he did believe in penance and doing penance for sin. I'm not sure of his exact beliefs on that. Like I said, he didn't leave many writings, so it's a little bit hard to figure out exactly what he means, but he was Catholic, so yeah, that was part of it, I think. Paul first. There, yeah.
I was wondering if you could learn something from that. We hear more about that today also. We're talking about counseling. About hating themselves, we talk about it normally in a negative way. Paul said, no one ever has hated himself.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just curious what can you learn from that? I mean, how should you look at that?
I'm not sure. I don't know exactly what he meant here. I took it to mean more of like a crucifying himself, basically not stopping caring about anything regarding your own self. But yeah, I don't know. It doesn't make it very clear. So, someone else, Ellie.
You probably covered it, but what was his spirit about enemies as far as Christ's teaching?
That's interesting. That's a good point. It's a little bit controversial. So in his youth, he was very much for war and went to war happily. But after his conversion, he certainly wasn't anymore. Now, the Catholics would still try to make you believe that he was pro-crusades and was involved in promoting that. But I think if we look at his life and what he was trying to do when he went to the Crusades, he was against conflict, because he put himself in extreme danger to try to convert the Sultan there and was trying to stop the Crusades if possible. Now, he did want them to be successful and did want the Holy Lands to come back into Christian rule, but he was trying to do that by converting them rather than simply by killing them, which was a good thing, I would say. Possible.
And Jesus said he who does not hate his own life also would be
a hypocrite. Yeah, we probably wouldn't agree with everything that they taught and with all the rules. I didn't actually read every single one of the ordinances. We probably wouldn't agree with all of them, especially them coming from a Catholic background, but for the most part I see Francis as much more of a Christ follower than a Catholic. It seems he lived that out much better in his life than some other Catholics. So. Any other questions? All right, well, I think I'll turn the time back over to you, Willard, and close.